Hi, Marco Werman here. We've heard from so many listeners during this fundraiser about when and where they listen to The World, walking through London during a lunch break, or listening in from Nikiski, a town in southern Alaska, or while sipping morning coffee in Rome, or making dinner, or commuting. The when and where might be different, but the why is often the same, because you care about the world around you, about the stories and events beyond our borders, and about people whose voices are seldom heard. It means a lot to us making the program that you care and that you show your support financially as well. There's still time to make your gift before the end of the calendar year. We need your help to reach our goal. Contribute today and join so many others from every corner of the globe who support our program. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The Omicron variant is spreading quickly across the UK. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is sounding the emergency alarm.
There is a tidal wave of Omicron coming, and I'm afraid it is now clear that two doses of vaccine are simply not enough.
Also today, after a brawl at a rally for a French presidential candidate, France gets set to outlaw an ultra-right group.
They seem to be neo-fascist. Some of them was even neo-Nazi.
And the Prime Minister of Israel pays a visit to the Arab Gulf to deepen ties and unite against a common adversary. Plus, President Biden again warns Russia to stay out of Ukraine. Putin might be more persuaded by the reality of what an invasion might mean.
Russia can take a big bite out of Ukraine, but it might well break a tooth in doing so.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us this Monday. Britain woke up today to the reality of another COVID Christmas. Emergency measures to handle what the Prime Minister called a tidal wave of Omicron. The other COVID headline from the UK is the first confirmed death from the Omicron variant. From London, Leo Hornack has our report.
Here in Britain, as in many countries, we've got used to the idea of COVID emergencies, of sudden restrictions to daily life, of healthcare systems under pressure, and of the threat from an ever-evolving virus.
Good evening. Over the past year, we have shown that vaccination is the key to beating COVID and that it works.
And it's for that reason, perhaps, that Prime Minister Boris Johnson used strong terms in a special live address to the nation Sunday night.
I need to speak to you this evening because I'm afraid we're now facing an emergency in our battle with the new variant, Omicron. There is a tidal wave of Omicron coming, and I'm afraid it is now clear that two doses of vaccine are simply not enough to give the level of protection we all need.
Britain's Omicron tidal wave hasn't yet peaked, and the science is still unclear on how big it might be and how it might interact with existing vaccination efforts. A study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine projected a worst-case scenario of 75,000 Omicron deaths by May. Hospitalizations from COVID are already up week on week. So, as of today, Britain is again on an emergency footing. This time to get fresh booster vaccinations in as many arms as possible before Christmas family reunions provide an opportunity for Omicron. The military has been deployed to help with vaccinations. Walk-in health centres have sprung up on high streets. And then there is the National Health Service booking system.
Good evening. Thank you for calling Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust.
If you are phoning to inquire about the coronavirus vaccination programme...
The National Health Service's website has been crashing for hours. Although, on the quiet, people know that showing up in person is a lot more effective than sitting at home and clicking refresh. Oxford University's Professor Carl Hennigan sounded a warning on the UK's Times radio today.
What we can't do each year is stop healthcare, switch it off, and replace it with a vaccine system that says for the next month, we're switching off healthcare. We have to think wider about what's going on in the context of healthcare.
So far, around 23 million people have received a booster. But at that rate, it will take until late February before everyone has been boosted. Way too slow for Christmas dinner.
Get boosted now for yourself, for your friends and your family. Get boosted now to protect jobs and livelihoods across this country. Get boosted now. Thank you very much.
For The World, I'm Leo Hornack in London.
When President Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin last week, the top thing on the agenda was the buildup of Russian troops along the Ukrainian border. Biden sent clear warnings to Putin, do not invade. Biden spoke about that this weekend at a press conference in his home state of Delaware.
I've made it absolutely clear to President Putin, it's the last thing I'll say, that if he moves on Ukraine, the economic consequences for his economy are going to be devastating.
For the latest, we're joined now by Mark Galliotti with the British think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. So it's been 6 days, Mark, since the meeting between Biden and Putin. What are your takeaways since then? What have you observed as the two leaders return to their respective corners?
Well, the Russian troop movements certainly have not stopped. There's no sign of de-escalation there. Quite the opposite. There's more forces moving in. Actually, the Russians have come back essentially by escalating their demands. They want cast-iron legal guarantees that NATO will not extend eastwards, that neither Ukraine nor Georgia will at any point be allowed to join the Security Alliance, and also that NATO won't base any kind of weapon systems that could be threatening to Russia on neighboring countries. And that includes, after all, NATO countries. Now, this is something they must know that the West cannot accept. So we can hope that this is just, in a way, the first stage of a haggling process. But at the moment, it's one hell of an ask.
So the military buildup from the Russian side has continued. Does it look to your eyes like the buildup has a clear purpose?
Yes, look, there's no question about it that this is the kind of buildup which, if you are looking for a major incursion into Ukraine, this is what you would generate. You generate not just the frontline forces to do the fighting, but also the logistics, the rear area stuff, making sure you've got the ammunition and the supplies and all the transport and such like. So we don't yet know, and probably Putin doesn't know for sure, whether this is ultimately one very, very realistic bluff or whether this is the real preparations for war. And I think this is classic Putin. He's giving himself two potential routes.
So elaborate a bit more on the Ukraine military side. What can you tell us about their military preparedness? Can it defend itself if Russian troops do come across the border?
I mean, in some ways, the best way that I can put it is actually a line that I got from a Russian military analyst when I was in Moscow last month, which is Russia can take a big bite out of Ukraine, but it might well break a tooth in doing so. The Ukrainian military is stronger than it's ever been. I mean, if in 2013, 2014, it was basically in collapse and, you know, they were having to rely on volunteer militias and so forth. Now they've got 250,000 men and women under arms with some very, very sort of well-learned combat experience from the undeclared war that's been going on in the Donbass region. They have been trained by the Americans and the British. They've got at least a limited number of very modern, for example, anti-tank missiles, javelins. So, look, they absolutely could deliver a certain sort of pain to the Russians. But when it comes down to it, the Russians, they have air power, they have long-range firepower, massive advantages. On the battlefield, the Russians would win in the initial engagement. The thing is, if the Russians end up trying to occupy territory, they're going to find themselves in a guerrilla war against a people who absolutely regard them as a hostile alien invader.
Would NATO countries step up to defend Ukraine if Russia were to attack?
I think it's fairly clear that there will not be any question of NATO troops being sent in to defend Ukraine for all kinds of reasons, including the fact that Ukraine is not a NATO member and therefore doesn't have the same guarantees. On the other hand, I mean, beyond the threat of sanctions, we've seen military assistance being provided to Ukrainians. It's not impossible that if that did happen, there would be behind the scenes, perhaps with special forces and some kind of assistance being provided. But essentially, this is a war that the Ukrainians will have to fight. We can support them in every way we can, but it's the Ukrainians that will be fighting and dying.
Mark Galeotti is an expert on Russia's security services at the British think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, speaking with us about the growing military tension between Russia and Ukraine. Mark, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
We've got our eyes on another diplomatic mission that's underway. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken lands in the capital of Indonesia today. Just last month, President Joe Biden told Indonesia's president that his leadership is essential to stability in Asia, and he praised Joko Widodo's commitment to democracy. But officials in Jakarta, the capital, often complain that the Americans all but ignore them. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins me now. So what is Secretary Blinken trying to achieve in Indonesia, Patrick?
In short, Marco, the U.S. is worried about China, Chinese influence in Indonesia. China is Indonesia's biggest trading partner. Chinese companies build lots of factories. They invest heavily in Indonesia. And in the vaccine diplomacy game, China has given 80% of Indonesia's COVID-19 vaccines. America has given way fewer to Indonesia. So this is a problem. The U.S. will keep saying it cares about Indonesia, but the U.S. has this reputation for snubbing Indonesia and not sending top officials very often, and that allows Beijing to fill the void. So Secretary Blinken is coming to convince leaders face-to-face, you know, we do care about you. He's going to give a speech about investment, and the reputation in Indonesia, Marco, is that the U.S. just comes and talks about military issues, tries to bring them onto some sort of anti-China alliance, wants to sell them weapons. So they're going to be looking to Blinken to see, is he just going to talk about China, 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 or does the U.S. have more to offer?
Right. So Indonesia has these strong ties with China, some dependence on China. How is Indonesia likely to receive America's tough messaging on China?
They're not a big fan. To quote Indonesia's foreign minister, we don't want to get trapped by this rivalry. Just historically, during the Cold War, Indonesia was this battleground. You had the U.S. backing these mass killings of leftists, helping install a right-wing dictator. The Indonesian people had to overthrow him only about 20, 23 years ago. So today, that has inculcated this feeling of them wanting to say, we're not getting aligned with team anyone, any superpower. We want to get along with the U.S. We want to get along with China, Iran, and Russia. We're not on anyone's team. So they don't like being pulled in one direction or the other. They don't want to be on Team China either, Marco. I mean, they're also worried about Chinese military domination in their region. And these two countries aren't a natural fit. One is a democracy, one is authoritarian. But the fact is, so far, China has been investing a lot of time, interest, and money into Indonesia, and Beijing gets rewarded with a lot of influence, more than the U.S.
Okay, aside from wanting to get along with Washington, what does Indonesia really want from the U.S.?
Investment. Indonesian officials are very clear on this. Investment, infrastructure. It does just so happen that Blinken will cover those themes in a speech in Indonesia tomorrow. They're looking forward to that. But remember, the U.S. has this habit of saying the right things to Indonesia and then getting distracted. And during the Trump era, just basically ignoring them. Trump also pulled out of this Asian Economic Trade Pact, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was the centerpiece of Obama's so-called pivot to Asia. And so now the U.S. has to determine what it's going to do, what it's going to bring to Indonesia and the entire region. So Blinken is basically going to go in there and answer this question. What is the U.S. presenting now? So far, there actually aren't that many details. We don't know exactly what he's going to say tomorrow.
Patrick Nguyen is the world's Southeast Asia correspondent, speaking with us from Bangkok, Thailand, about Antony Blinken's mission to Indonesia. Thanks very much, Patrick. Good to speak.
Thanks, Marco.
People around the world only have a few more days to get on Santa's nice list. Here's one person who might have just landed on the naughty one. And you parents of little ones, you might want to establish a cone of silence here for about 50 seconds. All right, just the grown-ups listening now, here goes. Bishop Antonio Stagliano in Sicily, he reportedly told a group of children that Santa Claus does not exist and that Santa's red costume had been chosen by Coca-Cola for publicity. Parents were not happy, and the bishop had to do some damage control.
Cari bambini, non ho detto, come ricorderete bene.
In an apology video that opens in contrite tones with, "Dear children," the bishop said he meant to tell the children about the true meaning of Christmas, less gifts, more focus on how Jesus' life was a gift to all. He ended his apology with a classic Italian Christmas lullaby.
Dalle stelle, ore del cielo,
A beautiful song, but Santa's verdict is still out.
E vieni in una grotta freddo al gelo.
I think we can give the bishop a few points for his recovery. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A leading far-right presidential contender in France, Eric Zemmour, recently launched his campaign with a huge rally in the Paris suburbs. The candidate taunted journalists and denounced immigrants. A violent brawl broke out when an ultra-right group, the Zouave, threw punches and chairs at protesters who wore anti-racism t-shirts. The Zouave supporters chased the protesters out of the convention center, chanting in French, "Everyone hates Antifa." Jean-Yves Camus is a political analyst from the Jean Jaurès Foundation. He's in Paris, and he's been watching the growth of the Zouave.
They seem to be neo-fascist. Some of them was even neo-Nazi and prone to violence. They do not publish anything, no book, no leaflet, and they do not even have a website, so most of their communication is through Telegram, but it's some kind of a street gang.
These are people who have attacked others who wear Say No to Racism t-shirts. I mean, does that imply that the Zouave are essentially pro-racist? Are they proudly racist?
Yes, they are. I would say, in comparison, they look very much like the Proud Boys. I think that the Zouave are much like the skinhead gangs of the 1980s, 1990s.
So they have provoked some violence in recent weeks, last month attacking people in a Paris bar known as an anti-fascist hangout, and last week at a political rally for far-right presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. What happened there?
Zemmour is a pretty much controversial candidate because of what he says on immigration and French identity. So several members of an anti-racist NGO whose name is SOS Racisme decided to enter the building where Zemmour was making a speech and peacefully demonstrate. There were several young women among them. They had no intention to fight. They just displayed a T-shirt with "No to Racism" written on it. And suddenly they were attacked by a group of people wearing face masks. And it happened that those people were the Zouave.
What about Eric Zemmour, the candidate himself? Does he openly support the Zouave?
He does not. And it seems from what I get from insider sources, this is an embarrassment to his campaign because this was the launch of his political party. The meeting was broadcast live on many private channels here in France. And that's quite bad publicity.
So now the Zouave are facing several legal actions. France's interior minister is taking legal action to dissolve them. Will it be possible to outlaw this group?
It is entirely, because French law gives the minister the possibility of outlawing any group that either incites to violence or is terrorist or potentially terrorist or incites to racial hatred. This is a violent street gang, and as such, it can be banned. The only question is, are bans really effective? I mean, when you belong to a group that has been banned, do you move to another group? And there are still a few who might continue in the same extreme right movements and simply move to another group.
So as the French Interior Ministry tries to ban Les Zouaves, I'm wondering whether there's a discussion around freedom of speech, banning a political group in a country that embraces freedom of speech.
We do embrace freedom of speech, but because of this specific history of France and European countries, especially in the 20s and 30s and 40s, we have always tried to balance freedom of speech on the one hand and the protection of the state on the other hand. It will be the sixth group from the extreme right that will be banned by the Macron government. That's pretty much.
Jean-Yves Camus is a political analyst with the Jean Jaurès Foundation, speaking with us from Paris about the far-right group Les Zouaves. Thank you very much, Jean-Yves.
Thank you.
A quick note on a high-profile Me Too case in China. Yesterday, we learned that a woman who publicly accused her boss and a company client of sexual assault, she's been dismissed. The business was none other than China's tech giant Alibaba, often called the Amazon of China. The alleged victim announced that her contract was terminated at the end of last month for, quote, spreading falsehoods about the company. It's led to a hot debate on Chinese social media. Some support Alibaba's firing of the employee and believe she lied about her experience. Others say her rights should be protected. Meanwhile, online discussions about another Me Too case in China remain blocked on social media, that case involving tennis star Peng Shuai and her claims against a former top government official. A dying coral reef looks very different from a healthy one. Less color, fewer fish. It also sounds different. In Indonesia, scientists say they're now using underwater recordings to track how much one giant reef has come back to life. The world's Anna Kusmer has our report.
This is what damaged parts of a big reef in Indonesia sound like.
We just hear that crackle of snapping shrimp and often very little else.
University College London PhD student Ben Williams works on underwater acoustic monitoring. On a healthy reef, he says, crustaceans and fish make a lot more noise.
These go from simple things to kind of croaking or grunting, all the way up to these really unexpected whooping or foghorn-like sounds.
Williams and his colleagues wanted to know whether these differences could measure the health of recovering coral reefs. In a study published this month in the Journal of Applied Ecology, they found they could. They recorded sounds from a reef in central Indonesia that had been badly damaged by people fishing with dynamite.
This leaves a rubble field of dead coral that fails to recover for decades, if ever at all. We call them killing fields.
About a decade ago, conservationists introduced one of the largest reef restoration projects in the world there. This new study shows the effort is working.
They're able to establish a high amount of coral cover, again, within just a couple of short years.
Lucille Chapuis, a study co-author from University of Exeter in the UK, says her favorite sound is the damselfish.
It's a very cute little yellow fish.
She thinks they sound like windshield wipers on a dry day.
That a bit.
Chapuis says recording sound underwater can be a cheap and easy way to measure reef health.
The usual way is that there are actually divers going down and counting every fish they see. That's quite an effort.
Audio recordings have been used on land to track recovery of bat and bird populations. Peter Tayak is an expert on bioacoustics at University of St. Andrews in Scotland, not involved in the study. He says sounds can capture a lot more time and space than visual surveys.
So we can get a much richer idea of how animals' use of the environment changes throughout the day, throughout the year, and over time as environments either are degraded or recover.
Study author Ben Williams says close listening makes the reef come alive in a new way.
These ecosystems are well known for being vibrant, colorful places to look at, but fewer people know that the sounds we hear on them are just as rich.
He hopes to go back again to hear how things continue to change. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
And you're listening to The World. When the Taliban took over Afghanistan, some college students desperately tried to continue their studies abroad. First, they had to get past border checkpoints and a Taliban guard with a stick.
And he told me that, look, girl, you have no right to speak anymore. We are not like the previous government to give you the right. You speak with that stranger.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Belarus, speaking out against the government carries a lot of risk these days. President Alexander Lukashenko is taking a hard line against his critics. For some of them, it's time to get out. That includes members of the Belarus Free Theater. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry caught up with some of them and has this report.
Actors with the Belarus Free Theatre are rehearsing a scene from their play Discover Love at the Czech Embassy in London. The play is based on a true story. It's about the disappearance of Belarusian businessman Anatoly Krasovsky more than 20 years ago. Natalia Kaliada, co-founder of the theatre group, tells me that Krasovsky's wife, Irina, is a close friend.
The whole story is a love story. They lived together for 25 years, but they didn't manage to have wedding anniversary because her husband, Anatoly, was kidnapped and killed.
Kaliada is talking to me from a train station in Brussels. She's just had a meeting with the vice president of the European Parliament. Kaliada is trying to persuade European lawmakers to take stronger action against Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, who's been in power for almost three decades. Most of Kaliada's theatre group are now in London. Svetlana Sugaka, the company's managing director, fled the country in October.
So we understood that at some point KGB will come for us. And then we understand that October was our last chance to escape safely.
Sugaka won't tell me how she left, because she says it's a route others might want to take in the future. In Belarus, she says, the police can detain you for no reason. Sugaka has already been arrested by authorities twice. The last time was on election day in August of last year, when President Lukashenko claimed a landslide victory amid widespread allegations of election fraud.
At least one person died as bloody clashes in Belarus erupted between police and protesters on Monday. People took to the street in the capital, Minsk, after the opposition accused President Alexander Lukashenko on rigging his re-election.
Svetlana Sugaka says she was detained outside of a polling station without explanation and taken to a prison on the outskirts of Minsk. She says she was held in a cramped jail cell with 35 other people for 5 days.
They just beat you, scream on you, and 3 days we spent there without any food or even water or even air because it's too many people there. And I still can say that it was 5 days in hell.
Sugaka says she'll continue to speak out against the government, something she'd be unable to do if she was stuck in jail back home. Theatre co-founder Natalia Kaliada has been living in exile in London for 10 years. She was forced to flee Belarus with her husband in 2011, but the couple still get death threats. Last December, a state-run Belarusian newspaper published an article saying the pair would be hunted down and hanged side by side. Kaliada says she knows she could still be targeted in Britain.
We never feel safe, but we do not think about it because we need to be very rational and logical. When dictatorship will be over, then it will be time for us to reflect how scary it was.
Members of the Belarus Free Theatre are now in the UK on artist visas, but these run out in less than 6 months. So this week, some of them are travelling to Poland to see if they can settle there permanently. Kaliada says she regrets that the theatre company won't have a base in Belarus, but she says the actors will continue to perform.
That's major priority because our audience in Belarus is saying that images of our shows help them to go through jail time.
Svetlana Sugaka's partner has joined her in London too. She says she doesn't mind where they end up living long term, as long as the theatre group is together.
The rest doesn't matter what country it will be, because we more than a theatre company. We are a family who works together for 16 years already, and we're growing up together and laughing and crying together. We're free and free to do what we love to do.
Early next year, Belarus Free Theatre will begin rehearsals for its upcoming show at London's Barbican Centre. It's a dystopian thriller called Dogs of Europe. The play explores the dangers of looking away when authoritarianism takes hold. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
A diplomatic visit that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago is happening today. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is in the United Arab Emirates. It's the first time an Israeli prime minister has visited the UAE since the two nations normalized relations last year. It also illustrates some of the quickly shifting allegiances in the region. It's notable, for example, that even as the UAE is strengthening relations with Israel, it's also improving ties with Israel's major rival, Iran. With us to explain how all of this could work is Sanam Vakil. She's the Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House, a think tank in London. Sanam, let's start with a visit today by Israeli Prime Minister Bennett to the UAE. How significant is this? What does it really mean?
This is, of course, hugely significant. Bennett is the first Israeli leader to visit the UAE, and this signifies the impact of normalization between the two countries and, above all, brings Israel out of isolation regionally. And the Israeli government is hoping to build a broader pattern of normalization.
So explain how the balancing act is going to work. How will the UAE work with Iran and Israel, especially when there's so much tension between the two?
In 2019, the UAE was made vulnerable to Iranian pressure tactics in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement. And so this recalibration that the UAE is pursuing vis-a-vis Iran is designed to protect the UAE in its strategic to prevent further attacks. I wouldn't overstate it, though, because the UAE at the same time sees itself as a rising regional influencer. And so it wants to show that it can be nimble, maintain pragmatic relationships with Iran, while also pursuing broader objectives of integration and stronger ties with Israel.
So prior to the normalization of relations last year between the UAE and Israel, what were the state of relations between the UAE and Israel and the UAE and Iran? I mean, what is going to be the harder circle to square for the UAE?
The UAE will be under pressure from Israeli officials to align and isolate the Islamic Republic. But the UAE, I think, will most clearly be articulating to Israeli officials that its geographic and demographic proximity to Iran make it more vulnerable. The UAE supported President Trump's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, supported the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement in the hope of getting a better agreement. But there has not been a better agreement, nor has there been an effort at achieving a broader agreement vis-a-vis Iran. So this tactical calibration from the UAE's side is to protect Emirati interests.
So how uncomfortable is Israel about UAE's attempt to strengthen relations with Iran?
The UAE sees Iran's regional influence and missile program as primarily threatening, whereas Israel, in its listing of primary threats coming from Iran, sees Iran's nuclear program as primarily threatening. So this asymmetry in threats coming from Iran is the problem, and hence we have a tactical difference in strategy.
Sanam, this news of Prime Minister Bennett's visit comes right before the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC. That's the regional political body, and it's not all on board about having relations with Israel. How do they handle the UAE strategy?
Both Saudi Arabia and Qatar have had very quiet, understated ties with Israel, but neither of the two countries are willing to normalize with Israel because the principal issue of Palestinian statehood remains unresolved. So I think the onus is on the international community and these states to pressure Israel to address the issue of statehood in Palestine.
Sanam Vakil, the Deputy Director and Senior Research Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. She's been speaking with us from London. Sanam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
The Korean War never ended. North Korea and South Korea signed an armistice in 1953 to end hostilities, but never a peace treaty. So technically, the two sides are still at war. Today, they signal that they could agree in principle to eventually signing a formal peace treaty. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has staked his legacy on making progress on this. He leaves office in March. Joining me now is Jenny Town, the director of the Stimson Center's Korea Policy Project, 38 North. Jenny, what is the impetus behind this agreement to finally bring the Korean War to an official close? Why now?
Well, what we're talking about here isn't actually a peace treaty, but something that they're calling an end of war declaration. And so it's a political declaration that basically states that we consider the war to be over. And it's sort of a promissory note to say that we're moving in the direction of actually negotiating the peace treaty. Why now? Well, I think, you know, this is something that has come up several times throughout history. Can this jumpstart and restart the diplomatic process as a symbolic gesture to say that our relationship is moving in a different direction?
What is Washington's role in this kind of statement of intent, this preamble to further discussions?
Well, the two Koreas have already said that the war is over, but the armistice was signed between North Korea and the U.S. We are the key players.
For you personally, Jenny, what intrigues you the most about this political turn in the North Korea-South Korea saga?
Well, I'm not sure it is an actual turn. This concept of an end of war declaration is something that has been talked about a lot since 2018. But right now, even the North Koreans, when this has been brought up, have basically said this is not the right time. Because it has no legal standing, it doesn't actually change anything else in the region, especially trends of a growing nuclear arms race that's going on in the region. None of that changes.
So why is this important to South Korea?
One, for President Moon's own legacy, political legacy, because he did put so much emphasis on trying to build this peace process. But more urgently, to try and get the U.S. and North Korea to start negotiating again, because the inter-Korean agenda at this point in time is basically in gridlock, because they can't get the cooperation that they need from the international community to be able to move forward on the inter-Korean agenda, such as resuming economic cooperation projects like Mount Kumgang tourism.
What Mount Kumgang tourism? Explain that.
So Mount Kumgang is a north-south joint tourist area. I believe it's a ski resort. It was closed back in 2008. There was a South Korean tourist who was accidentally shot. The tourist zone was closed afterwards and hasn't been operating since then, but it was an exclusive joint economic project between the two Koreas that a lot of South Korean tourists were going to resort in this area and experience North Korea.
So I hear you saying, Jenny, that we should take this agreement with a serious grain of salt. What will you be looking for, though, to see if progress is going to be building on this symbolic political agreement?
Well, I think, you know, the message that Moon just sent, while the headline is that the North Koreans have agreed in principle to an end of war declaration, they're still refusing to negotiate without preconditions. And this is something that they had said, you know, back in September, that the idea was admirable. They would want at least North Korea, South Korea, U.S., and China to be part of those negotiations. But until the U.S., you know, removes its hostile policy, they're not willing to negotiate at this time.
Jenny Town is the director of 38 North, a North Korea policy think tank. Jenny, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The king of ranchero music has died at the age of 81. Mexican singer Vicente Fernandez was a legend. He sold more than 50 million records worldwide, won 3 Grammys, and earned recognition across the Spanish-speaking world. From Mexico City, the world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has this remembrance.
The singer Vicente Fernandez is such a big figure that he can fill arenas, even if he's not performing in them. Thousands of fans filled up a coliseum near his home in the western state of Jalisco just hours after his family confirmed he died yesterday morning. Famous singers like Ricky Martin and George Strait called him a hero, and presidents Andrés Manuel López Obrador of Mexico and even Joe Biden said he had left a mark in his more than 60 years as a performer.
Bueno, Jorge, como todo mundo, empecé cantando allá en Guadalajara siguiendo los carros.
Fernandez, in an interview on Mexican television in the 1990s, remembered how he started out singing as a teenager alongside mariachi musicians at a restaurant in Guadalajara. By his mid-20s, he signed his first record deal with the Mexican imprint of CBS. And not long after, his fame spread north to the United States and south across all of Latin America.
No, Vicente Fernandez en Colombia fue un ídolo. Aquí anunciaron un concierto de Vicente Fernández y eso era la locura.
For example, in Colombia, he was an idol, says Carlos Eduardo Hernández, the longtime host of the popular music radio show Radio Recuerdos in Bogotá. Hernández got to see Vicente Fernández sell out 3 arenas, and he says the shows were madness, with many a fan sneaking alcohol into the venue.
Porque es que escuchar rancheras sin trago para la gente no tiene gracia.
Hernández explains that's because listening to rancheras, a genre mostly devoted to heartbreak, without drinking, to many fans, doesn't make sense.
Entonces eso era un coro completo, arrancaba Don Vicente a cantar y la gente lo seguía.
And when Vicente Fernandez would start singing, Hernandez remembers, it seemed like everyone in the arena was right there with him, singing word for word. He was prolific and put out dozens of hit singles like El Rey or The King or Mujeres Divinas or Beautiful Women. Fernandez put out more than 80 records and starred in more than 30 films. Hernandez says Vicente Fernandez's legacy is immense, not only because of Fernandez's personal fame, but because of his role in helping popularize Mexican rancheras across the continent. That's why mariachis from Los Angeles to Bogotá and farther south have been paying tribute to Fernandez with songs like Volver, Volver, or Come Back, Come Back, which he sang in front of 85,000 people in his last concert 5 years ago in Mexico City. Y volver, volver, volver a tus brazos otra vez. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Nos dejamos hace tiempo, pero me llegó el momento.
When the Taliban took over Afghanistan, life for Afghan college students changed dramatically. Today we have the story of a couple of hundred of them. With help from a small liberal arts college in the U.S., the young Afghans made it to Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia to resume their studies. Levi Bridges has their story from Kyrgyzstan's capital, Bishkek. We're only using their first names to protect their families back in Afghanistan.
Do you want them to be on the stage with you?
About 40 Afghan students are standing in front of a small stage at the American University of Central Asia. Fluorescent lights gleam on polished wooden floors. The whole scene feels kind of high school musical, except for the music itself. A couple of guys are about to rehearse a song for the university's upcoming Afghan Cultural Day. Now, these are college students. Young folks. But I'm looking around right now, and seriously, I don't see anyone staring at their phones. Everybody's looking right at the stage. The American University in Bishkek is called AUCA for short. It's closely affiliated with Bard College in New York. More than 300 Afghans study here. Last summer, many of them were back home visiting family when Kabul fell. Neil was one of them.
All of a sudden, we got a call from university that all the flights are canceled. You cannot go anywhere.
Bard College helped organize a pretty daring rescue attempt to get these students back to Kyrgyzstan and about 100 more new students whom they were able to secure scholarships for. Some got out on flights, but many students, especially women like Neil, were snuck out of the country by car.
I was wearing like hijab. We were all wearing black scarves, huge one. Because while leaving the country, we had to have a proper hijab, proper clothes.
They kept getting stopped at Taliban checkpoints. Neil hid her laptop in her clothes because she didn't want the Taliban to suspect she was a student. And when they finally got to the border with Pakistan, there was a big crowd. And these Taliban started ordering her not to get too close to any men.
And we were not have no idea how to make the distance from the male because the way was very narrow. Then two Talib came inside with the stick in his hand. And like, if I would not move, he would start beating me with that stick. So I was like, okay, I'm leaving this place. And he told me that, look, girl, you have no right to speak anymore. We are not like the previous government to give you the right so you speak with that stranger.
Once they crossed the border, Neil and the other women flew to Kyrgyzstan.
It was a team operation of incredibly dedicated people who basically didn't sleep for 6 weeks.
Jonathan Becker is the executive vice president of Bard College. He helped evacuate 177 students to Kyrgyzstan in total. Becker says they couldn't have pulled it off without officials in Pakistan and Kyrgyzstan who help the students secure the necessary paperwork.
And we think students studying and being in educational institutions is a much more productive approach than having them sit in refugee camps somewhere.
Becker says universities can play a key role during disasters. Others are stepping up to welcome Afghan students and scholars. But experts I talked to in the U.S. and Europe said they weren't aware of many large-scale efforts to evacuate Afghan students. But the educational needs there are staggering.
More than 50% population of Afghanistan are youth between the ages 18 to 25. So we're talking about millions of people.
Zarlash Zarmast is writing part of her master's thesis about education in Afghanistan at AUCA.
In some provinces, girls are only allowed to go to school until third grade, and in some until sixth grade, and in some not at all.
And for university students, Zarmas says options are shrinking. Afghan universities are shutting down, in part because families just can't pay tuition.
Previously, they could go abroad for studies. They still can do that, but getting a visa is almost impossible because so many of the embassies are closed.
And that is part of what makes the arrival of all these Afghan students in Kyrgyzstan so unique. After weeks of rehearsals, the students finally put on their performances for AUCA's Afghan Culture Day.
Hello, dear AUCA community!
A couple hundred students gather before a stage decorated in black, red, and green balloons, the colors of the old Afghan flag. There is singing, gorgeous dances, and, of course, poetry. At the end, the performers stand together wearing traditional clothing, representing ethnicities from all over Afghanistan. Shadukh helped organize the event.
Afghanistan is much more colorful than people think. Afghanistan is more than just a war zone or a place where women are suppressed.
As I listen to the songs today, I keep thinking about this way Neil described to me about what it felt like when Kabul fell.
Like, there's a sound of music, beautiful, playing around, and all of a sudden, it stopped.
Do you mean like metaphorical music?
Yeah. All of a sudden, things become mute.
Like someone hit the stop button on
yes,
a music.
Yes, like, and everything becomes so meaningless.
Today, here in Kyrgyzstan, the music is playing again. Back in Afghanistan, students hope it's just on pause for a while. The students I met here all said they dream about going back to Afghanistan someday to make their country a better place. For the World, Levi Bridges in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
Earlier, we told you about Antony Blinken's trip to Indonesia. The Secretary of State had a long flight and no doubt had plenty of debriefs to keep him busy. But as Blinken mentioned on Twitter, music has been a constant companion, so he created a Spotify playlist. Secretary's Travels, if you want to look it up. On the list, a group called Slank, one of the most popular Indonesian rock bands ever. They've been around since 1983 and are still going strong. Secretary Blinken added their power ballad Terlalu Manis to his playlist, a tune that raises a chicken and egg dilemma. Which came first, Slank or Guns N' Roses? We've also added this classic number by Indonesian rocker Slank to our playlist. You can find a link to that on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Thank you for the suggestions, Secretary Blinken. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Here's to a rockin' Monday. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.